one evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning. Down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, all the cops have wooden legs and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the big rock candy mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the big rock candy mountains.
This is Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. Colin and I are sitting in a lush, I guess I won't say lush,
lounge,
a mildly opulent lounge,
slightly Frank Lloyd Wright looking lounge
in the Granville Island Hotel. We're sitting with Sean Tan. Now you're here for the Vancouver's Writers Festival. I think it's a week long affair. You've got a couple of things happening this week, but this, of course, will be playing afterwards, so it's not even really going to help for promoting anything. Yeah. But you are the man behind the arrival. Book of a significant amount of acclaim. I know a fair amount of comics folks have been ranting and raving in glee of how much they loved it. And I know the Comics Journal, the guy that does the blog for us, it was his book of the year, and recently featured in the Crazy Show here in Vancouver. So a bunch of Vancouverites will be familiar through there. You were it was kind of odd in the Crazy Show because your work was quite different from everything else that was in it.
Okay.
This is one that Art Spiegelman and Seth Curie, yes, and everyone, yes, look like they kind of followed that school, uh-huh, of the post-underground.
Yeah.
And then there was your work, which, yeah, was kind of from the different direction.
Yeah. I guess, stylistically isolated and geographically isolated too, yeah. Probably the furthest far.
You were the only person that wasn't from North America.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was quite surprised about that because Raw magazine, being what it was all about international and all these incredibly European folks, and it was surprising not to see anyone like Tardy or Mobius. Well, I don't think Spiegelman's big on the Mobius stuff, but everyone wants Mobius, I hope.
Yes, yeah.
So the question is, I think, why have we never heard of you before? Where have you been?
I guess because I haven't been moving in comic circles. That's probably the answer. My background, first of all, is in painting, studying fine arts at university, not actually in a very practical way, but theory and criticism, but always interested in painting, you know, hoping to use that to become an artist of some sort. Eventually, when I finished university, I realised I wasn't actually qualified for anything, you know, I sort of had a very nice arts degree, and but while I was at university, I'd been working as a freelance illustrator, doing all sorts of odd jobs, you know, work that's totally unmemorable. And I thought I'd have a go at that just to make ends meet, pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of looking around to try and see what work was available, I ended up doing a lot of children's picture books and various, you know, children's illustration, both educational and trade. And that eventually led into picture books. And at first I was like, oh, you know, something to do. I wasn't that interested in picture books, and I sort of thought of them as being for, like, you know, real little kids and not the sort of stuff that I was so interested in at the time, which was actually mostly adult science fiction. And but, you know, I could see the opportunity to sort of steer it in a particular direction, and the editors were very receptive to my ideas. And so, you know, 10 or so years later, after entering that world, I've ended up being able to do The Arrival, which has been regarded as a comic. But I didn't realise it was a comic until about a little way into the project. And that's when I actually started reading comics. You know, actually, it's sort of part of my research.
How do these guys do this?
Well, pretty much that was it. Once the pages started to get broken into smaller and smaller pictures, I realised I had a problem. You know, I was drawing sort of comics the way maybe kids would draw comics in terms of basic composition, where you'd have people having a conversation and you just have, you know, two people standing there in the frame facing each other doing different gestures. And I thought, this just isn't working. It was boring.
The talking head syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. And what can I do about that, you know? And so I followed two strands of research. One was comics and the other was film storyboarding and just looking more closely at film, which is kind of parallel to comics.
Mm-hmm.
So what comics were you looking at?
Well, probably the one that... actually, what kind of steered me towards comics in the first place was looking at Raymond Briggs, who's in that Twilight Zone, you know, between picture books and comics. You know, what mm-hmm. is he? Is he a comics artist or is he a picture book illustrator? And I was just... I'm not so interested in definitions. I just thought, oh, here's a guy who's managed to get something published, which it must have been tricky in the British market, but it's been successful, and I'm not surprised because it's really great. And I came across his book, The Snowman, which was... I'd already decided that my book was going to be silent, partly because words just weren't working in the context mm-hmm. of what I was trying to do. And I came across The Snowman and thought, wow, this is like such a strong parallel for everything I've been trying to do. And that then led me into looking at other comics, you know, more other sequential art. And I was already familiar with Dave McKean and Neil Gaiman's books. A friend of mine a long time ago had introduced me to Daniel Clowes's 8-Ball, and so I went and looked at some of Clowes's work. And then I kept hearing about this Jimmy Corrigan's, you know, book, and I thought, okay, better check that one out.
If I need to go cry for a month.
Yeah, that's right. And it was in my local library, my suburban West Australian library, under young adult section, which strangely a lot of the Clowes work was too, inappropriately. I think, I wonder if anyone had actually read it.
I read Velvet Glove when I was about 15 or 16.
Really? Okay.
Maybe that explains a lot.
Yeah, yeah. They introduced a David Lynch too early or something.
Yeah, no, that happened too. I was raised on Akira Kurosawa movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's good.
I think so.
Could do worse.
Could do a lot worse.
Yeah. But, anyway, I started reading this book, and it was, I just thought it was amazing in terms of the visual language. And, you know, partly the appeal of it was those silent... I was looking for those silent passages,
mm-hmm.
and he has quite a few of them in there. Even where there are words used, they're not kind of...
they're not essential.
Yeah, they're part of the landscape or like a bit of scenery, verbal scenery. And, you know, even things like just showing some in great detail, someone putting a cup down, showing what a cafeteria table looks like. I don't know about for the general reader, but for, you know, another illustrator, I study all those things because I'm aware of the attention on those details. And even when you've got somebody waiting in a waiting room and there's 12 images of the person waiting, I always check to see that they're not duplicated, you know, that they're all individually hand-drawn. I was very pleased to see that they were. So I guess as a model of patience and, you know, other things, which it's famous for, just that graphic language and the use of 19th century visual literacy to some extent, you know, like the way it's designed and also the, you know, those older forms of looking. They also, I guess they encouraged me to pursue the direction I was going with this book.
So that doing this research kind of helped formulate where you're going with the story, like you weren't. Did you have like a set idea of where it was all, or it just kind of worked out on its own?
Yeah, I mean, originally it was actually, I mean, one reason the project took so long is because I didn't know what I was doing, and so I just had to keep redrafting it. Originally it was a 32-page picture book submission to a publisher, and I just said, you know, it's going to be 32 pages, each page is a landscape with a small amount of text, and it was about, an old man recalling the his journey to a country and making a life for himself there. And almost text that would by itself would read very straight and could be interpreted as you know, a typical, say, Greek Australian who, you know, been a post-war migrant and then was living in Australia, just reflecting on his journey. But the images would be almost slightly contradictory to that normalness, that there would be, you know, these landscapes showing really strange things happening in a world that was entirely imaginary. And then at the end it would just sort of show. It'd be all about hardship, and then at the end you'd have this image of his home where he's integrated all these weird things and he's living with all these weird things. So it was actually more like a children's picture book. In terms of simple idea and structure to some extent.
Now, was this the first story you'd written yourself? Because I know in the children's book industry, it's kind of looked down upon in some aspects to have someone write their own story where they work and more having that combination of writer-artist.
Yeah, that's probably true. I never really thought about it in terms of whether it's looked down upon or not, but it's, I think, partly a case of... a suspicion, perhaps, you know, like of an artist writing something because it's not necessarily their thing. And certainly I started working, I mean, The Arrival is my sixth picture book, and I still refer to it as a picture book rather than a comic. I just can't help it.
Oh, that's fine.
A book with pictures in it. Prior to that, the first three were collaborations with other writers, and I think that was necessary in order to for me to learn about picture books. I wouldn't have been confident at that stage to write my own, even though I was quite an avid writer, and also just to get a foot in the door of the industry and earn the trust of publishers, and you know, just prove to myself that I could meet deadlines and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they're kind of big projects to do picture books.
Now, how long did The Arrival take?
I think in terms of overall, you know, from conception to completion, 6 years from conception to completion. But in terms of actually, you know, parking myself and doing the work, it's about 4 years.
Wow.
Where it was like my, the project that was kind of my dominant project, even though it sometimes have to go into the background as I did work in order to pay the bills and that sort of thing. It was the thing I was devoted to for that period of time, and you know, you'd go to bed thinking about it.
Well, that's
every
the
night.
That is the cartoonist lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
For a lot of them doing the commercial work and
yeah, and just the nature of the images and the way they're rendered. It was incredibly slow, at least I found it was the case. I think it's much more logical if producing something like a comic to do what most comics do and depend heavily on outlines and a more simplified linear style. And I really, you know, I actually started drawing the book that way. It was actually in a much more, you know, simplified characters, you know, dots for eyes, heavy outlines, and...
clear line school?
sort of not entirely clear, but I guess objects were very discreet in scenes, so that is a bit like Chris Ware, and to some extent like Raymond Briggs, you know, although Raymond Briggs starts bleeding into some painting traditions where, you know, it's not the extent to which an image could be photocopied and still read, you know, starts to break down. But, you know, if you... it was also the perspective was a little isometric when I started doing the book, so instead of, you know, there being an elevated scene of a street piazza or something like that, and the perspective wasn't, you know, realistic perspective, it was more like that. I guess I was influenced by Chris Ware, that kind of isometric perspective where the lines are kind of parallel, they don't converge. And, you know, that was interesting. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking this would look really great if this was like old postcards and they looked like photographs. But no way would I ever be able to do that. And then at some point along the way, I just thought, I'm just going to have to, you know, because otherwise I'm doing it a second-rate book when there's a first-rate one that I know could be done.
So this project was really pushing your skills to another level that you hadn't done before.
Oh, certainly pushing my patience, at least. I think the skills were there. I was a bit worried at first if I could pull it off, because it had been a while since I had done things like life drawing and more realistic painting. When I started working, I did a lot of fantasy and science fiction book covers and became quite proficient at realistic painting. But as I moved into children's literature, I became more interested in abstracted figuration and, you know, found that realistic drawing style a little tedious. You know, where you'd spend all day working on someone's nose just so that people wouldn't notice. Whereas, you know, in a book like a picture book, The Red Tree, for instance, I just drew this girl with a ball for a head, you know, real simple hair, two dots for eyes and an angle for a nose, and that was it, perfect, you know. There's so much expression in that. And so I kind of felt weird to then be going back and drawing in that realistic style, where I knew I'd be wrestling with sleeves and the way light hits an upper lip and all these painful things that no one really cares about because they're only interested in the story.
But if it looks wrong, they notice.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, there's bits in the book now that annoy me because they, you know, on reflection, they don't look entirely right. You know, the way a hat sits on the head and things like that. I ended up also becoming quite dependent on photo reference, which is not something that I was comfortable with when I started. I thought, I have to resist this path, you know. It's evil to, you know, my drawing skills will rot and decay. And I found that that was the wrong way to think, that the focus was on the storytelling. And whatever could actually get me to move through the book with minimal attention to technical problems and focus more on storytelling and emotional content, then that would be the way to go. And so the project ended up becoming a lot of the creative work was actually in setting up photo shoots. And I, you know, built a little set in my garage and got people over and made them wear
clothes. Position them.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, with photorealism, or photo reference, I should say, how do you step away as far as separating it from being a copy of a photo to being what it is that you're doing?
Well, that's sort of been an intermediate process, which was largely digital, where I would take these images and... Well, I should say that at first I started taking photographs with a still camera and telling people what to do, and I realised that wasn't working because it looked like photographs taken where someone's telling someone what to do.
Kind of like an Alex Ross comic.
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, it would work, it would sometimes be good, and that language can be suitable for some projects, but for this, because the sequences were quite tight, and I felt it needed to have better acting, you know, involved. And so what I ended up doing was switching to video and filming people and loosening it up a bit, and just instead of telling them what I wanted in the scene, I did a sketch and said, you know, and I'd collaborate with them, go, what do you think about this, and describe the character, we think about the character a little bit, and actually get them to just play it out.
Wow.
And then I'd go through and meticulously pick out the frames that looked really, that captured, you know, the right expression. Sometimes it would be several frames that all had good bits, so chop them all up.
There's an arm, there's a good leg.
Exactly. Well, they were doing something which is really great, but there's a blurry hand, or, you know, the shadow's falling the wrong way across there. I actually became obsessed with lighting and and waiting for the right day. You know, don't come over yet. You know, it's
1 o'clock.
It's too
one
sunny.
O'clock.
Yeah. And then I would also draw over the top of the photograph. So you know, I'd arrange them in a rough composition in Photoshop, print them out, draw over them, put them back in. Sometimes draw directly using a tablet, and then. Print them out, and then I would redraw everything from scratch.
Wow.
So that's how it all kind of, the final process really welded everything together, so it became a singular world, especially mm-hmm. where there's fictional elements. Because if I showed you my layouts for each page as it was being produced, it just looks like such a ugly, incoherent mix of photographs, drawings, and you know, perspective lines going everywhere and little bits of tape where I've actually physically cut things and moved them around.
Well, we saw some of that at the Crazy Show.
Okay, yeah.
Well, that, and I think that's interesting because I find when you look, you can tell when someone's just directly copying a photo,
mm-hmm.
like a reference like Alex Ross or something like that. Not to diss on him, but I mean, he has that in the back of the, you know, he did the Marvels book column.
Oh.
And so you'll see in the picture back, you know, someone standing in the Galactus pose, and there's the painting of the guy standing in the Galactus pose, and it's just like...
Photo reference is a dangerous thing.
But it's used more than people think, but I think it's the fact that it's interesting is that it's that you remove the photo reference and you work with it and create something else. And
yeah. I guess I would be dependent on it mostly on those details where I felt not so confident... about how things look, so an odd angle on a head, and that photo reference would be invaluable, often with the children in the book, because I'm less used to looking at children and drawing children. That was, like, you know, really important. And it just it moves your confidence levels up to the things that are most important in storytelling. So you're not... because drawing is always a test, and if you get stuck on a detail... It can really leave you quite exhausted and also unprepared to go the next step and do all the other stuff, because you think, oh, every time you do a drawing, there's always a question, is this any good? And a lot of time, you know, the answer that comes back is no. But when you've got a photo reference there, you go, well, I know that I like that photo, and after spending 3 hours on this drawing, I can't tell whether it's good anymore. It looks a lot like that original photo, so it must be okay. And then you revisit it a couple of weeks later, and you might notice that it needs a little bit of adjustment. But generally, you've got that guide. It just helps you to move along.
I know for a lot of artists, doing that kind of photo realism painting can be quite maddening.
Yeah, it can. And I mean, I actually speculated about... producing the book as oil paintings.
Whoa.
And because I wanted to have that colour in there, and I thought, how can I get that colour? I don't really like using colour pencils so much there, but I also want to be able to create something that's manageable. And in the end, I experimented and found I could work in graphite pencil and digitally colour it, you know, separate dark areas and light areas out, and so break the drawing into layers and work on the layers and then put them together again. The thought of physically painting even just one panel, I thought, no, that's going too far.
So what was it rendered in, The Arrival?
In graphite pencil.
Wow.
It's now we're so focused on technical stuff.
Yeah.
I still have more technical questions, because I know, I think Renee French does similar.
Okay.
Another. Well, she's not in Australia right now, but she, I think, winters there or something. But her stuff is about the size that like gets as printed, the originals. What size is your stuff, the originals?
The book is about 70% of the originals, so where the pages are roughly A4, they're A3, if you use that measure here.
I'm not an artist.
We do have paper that's sold in A4 and whatnot.
Okay, well, it's about... Do you use the metric system?
Yes.
Good. It's about 30 by 40 centimetres.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Now, influences on it, because it's surrealist fantasy. I don't know if that's the right term to use.
It's a tricky one because so many, you know.
And Spiegelman was spouting off about how it's very surreal and the surreal aspects to it.
Sometimes I think I'd have to be a reader, you know, knowing less about it to be able to gauge that. because I draw what feels right to me, and that feeling of rightness comes from, you know, years of looking at lots of stuff. I'm not sure what in particular stands out the most. You know, I mean, we've all read so many books and seen so many paintings and watched so many films and read comics that, you know, all that stuff goes in.
It's got a certain, part of it gives me, that kind of Fritz Lang feel that...
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, I mean, there's one scene that's almost consciously Fritz Lang, which is where the, you know, these giants move through a town and
mm-hmm.
exterminate people and then... reconfigure the city somehow overnight so it looks like these concrete crazy prisms, which are sort of windowless buildings that just stick out at jagged angles. And that was, you know, not just Fritz Lang, but a lot of futurist stuff. Drawings by this kind of visionary architect, I think Hugh Ferris was his name, did this big, dark... imaginary buildings. Goya, to some extent, was an influence, you know, especially in the opening scenes where you have these black serpents swimming above this crumbling town, which is not unlike, you know, some of his...
his etchings?
Yeah, I forget what it's called, but it's that series of etchings based on, at the time, Spanish superstitions.
Right,
and,
I remember one. Don't know. Can't remember the name.
Yeah, but I mean the most well known one is the
Disasters of War.
Yeah, there's that one.
Yeah.
And also the particular etching. What is it? The Sleep of Reason brings forth monsters, or something like that. You know, where the guy's slumped over the desk and these black things. I mean, that's sort of the spirit of the Disasters of War. Was one he did shortly afterwards, and a really good example, actually, of you know, illustrated, a very early sort of illustrated book.
Oh, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, yeah. Just strange stuff, you know. I kind of like those artists that I never entirely get. You know, that's sort of a mystery, and even if you read about them, you still, yeah, I know all the context, but why did he paint it like that?
That's what we try to find out.
Yeah.
One aspect the book has is it's got a very muted feeling. Like, a lot of the facial expressions are, you know, not, like, wide open gaping.
Yes.
What was the attraction to the muted feeling? Because especially, like, it's a dark-colored book.
Uh-huh. I think, in part, it has something to do with looking at old photographs. And that the expressions in old photographs are fairly muted. And I think people were maybe conscious in those days of, you know, this invention, photography, and its significance as a moment of frozen time. I think they might have been quite put off by the idea of someone doing a candid gesture or a smile.
Well, I think they also had to sit there for about 10
minutes.
Well,
that's another thing, too. Yeah, and, I mean, they still could have smiled, but... It was like, it followed almost directly on from the tradition of portrait painting, which again is that muted expression of something of a record and the idea of a certain immortality. You don't sort of smile through eternity, you just look the way you do, you know. And that kind of record, I think the other thing too is maybe just it's an expression of my personality to some extent. I don't find myself attracted to extremely expressive gestures and facial expressions, and that's evident in all of my previous picture books. The characters are quite subdued and understated, and the text is very understated. Where I have written dialogue, it's extremely understated. Like, I find that very realistic and also sometimes hilarious, you know, when the dialogue is very understated but the situation is strange. I think it's true now that you mention it in this book, the fact that that aspect is muted means that there's more contrast with the fantastical elements of the world, so people aren't looking at something and you know, suddenly looking surprised or shocked, because I don't know, that's something for us to feel, and we may not be so surprised or shocked about it. We may have a different reaction. Mm-hmm. I guess it leaves it more open to be read. There's only maybe a couple of times where I had to have somebody sort of doing this startled appearance, and I felt actually a little uncomfortable about that, but it worked narratively. But that's a good question. I hadn't actually thought about it that much. It just felt natural, you know. That I think also the thing about being a new arrival to a country is trying to maintain some sort of sense of nonchalance in a strange situation. So, I mean, I do that all the time as a tourist. Like, you know, something I don't understand, I just sort of... And we all do, you know. Sort of like, to get by, you pretend that you're au fait with what's going on, and
it's like going to New York and trying not to be staring upwards.
Exactly, that sort of thing. Yep. Don't pull out that map. Just sort of, yeah, I know where I'm going.
It's Houston, not Houston Street.
Yeah.
Language, or lack thereof. The images used to represent language. Tell me about that.
You mean like, the imaginary like, alphabet?
Yeah.
That was a really early idea. In fact, the first things I created for the book back when I mean, everything else changed along the way because of stylistic changes, but the first thing I created that persisted through the whole project was an imaginary alphabet. And it's something I'd experimented with a bit on other projects. And I've always been attracted to things involving languages that I don't understand. Like, I love foreign cartoons, you know, where I can't read. It's kind of frustrating, but fascinating at the same time. And especially I love foreign onomatopoeic sound effects. That's one of my favourite things. But just the, you know, where the caption, I don't know, really gets your imagination going. You know, it almost is a richer reading experience when you don't understand what's going on. So, I like this idea of a place where... And it's also just a logical idea, just thinking in purely logical terms. Okay, if you want to show what it's like to be an immigrant, that's an important aspect, is the illiteracy aspect. And how do you best represent illiteracy? Well, we all know what it's like. We just go to a country where we don't understand the language, and suddenly we're illiterate. So, you just do something that's an equivalent.
In Australia, I mean, that must be especially prevalent because there's so many, outside of Australia, so many different countries with just completely different...
Yeah, that's true, actually, compared to here, yeah.
Here it's all the same.
Yeah, and...
Except more American flags if we go south.
Yeah, that's right.
It's called color without a U.
What's up with that?
So, Canadian spelling is British, is it? That's good.
Well, yeah, it depends how Canadian you are.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people use American just because it's, you know, we get so much of it here.
Well, you know, American English is actually more English than English English.
It's more, well, it's based on older?
I think so. You know, that the U comes from a French.
Ah.
I don't know much about my world history, but it's a French influence in British culture. Mm. And that's then been transported elsewhere. So we're actually... I think the American English is kind of like a... If you look at the old, you know, like pre-spelling English, They didn't use OUR, it was always OR.
Which is interesting because Quebec, they use an older form of French, because in France the language developed and changed over the 400 years since the settlements, so that would be the same with America, where the language hadn't developed, changed.
Yeah.
It really depends on which American English you're talking about, because there are different Englishes all across America.
Really?
Oh, there's some places on the East Coast, some islands off the East Coast that still talk in the almost Elizabethan,
really?
Cornish accents. It's amazing.
I gotta go there.
Actually, I was kind of curious. You were born in Australia.
Yeah.
So, on this is the arrival is an account of an immigrant coming to a new country. Uh-huh. So, where did you get stories from your family for that?
Partly because my dad is an immigrant. He's Chinese, Malaysian born Chinese, and so his parents originally from China. And he came to Western Australia as a student, and ended up. He didn't plan on. I could say that again. my dad came to Western Australia as a student, and he didn't plan on staying. But he met my mum, and they got married, and so he became an immigrant to Western Australia. I grew up just really used to that idea that my dad came from somewhere else in a place that I didn't know very well, so it was a bit of a mystery. And I've only visited where he's from, Penang, once when I was 13. So I kind of feel a little disconnected from that part of my family. My partner's Finnish, so she's an immigrant as well. You know, like... been living in Australia for about 12 years.
That's quite a different culture.
Yeah, it is. And it's actually interesting too, because a lot of her observations on everyday things are the kind of observations that could only come from somebody who's from a different culture. Finding certain aspects of Australian culture really amusing or charming, whereas obviously to me they're kind of like... might even be just anything from boring to annoying, you know. And I really love that foreign perspective. I think also just my interest in science fiction, you know, growing up, means that, I think there's just such a strong parallel between immigrant stories and science fiction stories. I'm surprised nobody that I know of has really explored that thoroughly. Like, I'm surprised that a book like The Arrival hasn't already been produced, because it seems like such an obvious representation of immigrant experience to treat it as a science fiction or an alternate world kind of story. I'm sure it must figure prominently in a lot of literature.
I think what tends to happen, now I'm not very well versed in science fiction, but what it tends to be is more of the uncharted lands,
yes.
Not necessarily already existing. Does that sound right?
I just read history books.
Well, a lot of science fiction, I guess it's close to this, is alternate history.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found that fascinating. And I've always felt like, that the world could, you know, we're living in one of a million possible worlds that may have come about due to any variations in history. So I don't see the world of this book as that implausible. Certainly some of the anti-gravity aspects of public transport, but just the idea of food being different, and
mm-hmm.
It's almost like if there was an eighth continent, you know, something could have popped up.
Well, it is quite interesting how different cultures are in these, like, far reaches of the world, and just how there's, like, all these completely different fruits and vegetables, like,
yes.
In China, there's some craziest stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And just the way, you know, different cultures have such a different flavour. It's not just a different country, it's a different universe.
Mm-hmm.
It has a different mental space. And entering that can be quite difficult, you know, actually really grasping it. Just getting back to the question about where the stories come from, I basically treated it from the outset as a kind of research essay. So I just did all my research, you know. I thought, well, where do I find immigrant stories? And there were a lot of anthologies. There was something actually on TV at the time, which was a sort of public broadcasting station had produced this series of interviews with immigrants, most people who were post-war immigrants, so interviewing them in the present and having them reflect on how they came to be in Australia, and I found that fascinating. And I just kept thinking in terms of parallels, you know, how can you come up with a parallel story? story to what they're saying. I think the problem with an issue like immigration, I know, like, for instance, when I was taught about immigration in school, is I found it boring, you know. It's like I couldn't relate to it, and it's like, so what, you know. What's that got to do with me? And what you forget is that if it was you travelling on that boat at that time, without the hindsight of how things were going to turn out, or you know, what Australia is actually like, it would have been quite a bizarre and sometimes wondrous experience.
Imagine coming from the UK to this land of kangaroos and Wallabies.
Exactly, yeah. And, the Australian historian and art critic Robert Hughes had this good comment in a book called The Fatal Shore, which was about the arrival of Europeans in Australia, and particularly British convicts. And he said it was like going to Australia was like going to the moon, but worse, because at least you could see the moon. You know, you knew what it was like, more or less. Australia was like a complete mystery for most of the people going there in the first instance, and against their will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that in itself, that's a whole other story that's worthy of another illustrated book. But I became interested in this idea of going, particularly those people, especially at around 1900, when there was like big waves of migration out of Europe, and a lot of people leaving out of desperation and not really knowing where they were going. And even in post-war era, you'd be given these sort of options. The United States, Canada and Australia would be kind of like a popular three options. And you know, I found a lot of people who were like living in Australia, they sort of picked Australia, and it was kind of like a random choice,
just threw the dart at the map.
Yeah, it's like that. Or they couldn't get into Canada, or you know, like often it was whatever was closest was their first choice, or where they already, there was some existing community.
Australia wasn't that far from many places in Asia.
Yeah, not in Asia so much. So yeah,
Europe, I guess.
Yeah, but for Europeans, it was kind of like,
well, a good place to go if you get kicked out of India.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, what do you have coming up in the future?
I'm working on a short animated film, which is an adaptation of a smaller picture book called The Lost Thing.
The
Lost Thing.
Oh.
Which is about a boy who discovers a large tentacled creature on a beach, and he decides to try and find out who owns it. So it's kind of like a classic picture book setup, but the treatment of it is fairly adult and quite dark. He's living in a city that's it's sort of a somewhat like the city of Terry Gilliam's Brazil, and the problem of this creature belonging in such a place is highlighted by the fact that people just don't really want to have anything to do with it because they're preoccupied. And that was a story I wrote 10 years ago, and it became very, very popular both amongst adult readers and kids. And I was approached by a company based in London originally. They've since got a production arm in Melbourne, and so I've been able to work directly on that project. And that's quite fascinating. It's a lot of work. It's very different to do an illustrated book.
One thing that I find interesting is how books that are quite dark, children latch on to them.
Yeah.
Do you ever get that surprise from people, like, going, kids like this, what?
Yeah, not so much questioning whether kids like it or not, but often adults expressing their own prejudices about what they think kids will think of it, which are often incorrect. Particularly if a book is about something dark, the feeling that it's inappropriate for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it is, you know, like a velvet glove. sometimes it isn't. It depends on the kids. I think with my own work, it's reasonably open enough that it doesn't, you know, it's very rarely violent. It doesn't state anything overtly. And the beauty of a book is partly that it's a medium that needs to be activated by the reader. It doesn't blare anything out at you. It's quite quiet and unassuming. And so, and also because I like to deal with images that are a little bit slippery in terms of meaning, it's unlikely a child's going to be traumatized by it. In a worst case scenario, they'll be perplexed or bored,
mm-hmm.
but they won't be traumatized. So, this was particularly the case with a book called The Red Tree, which I referred to briefly, mm-hmm. And another one called The Rabbits, which was the book that really established me as a known illustrator in Australia. It's probably less well known here. Both of those books deal with pretty dark themes. The Rabbits is about colonial invasion, and The Red Tree is about depression. That's not really a good description of either of them, but it's kind of the best I can do. You'd need to sort of check them out.
It's like a Velvet Glove is a travelling book.
Yeah, exactly. It's a road trip. So they both generated some negative reactions from adults, but I found kids really love them. Particularly I was surprised by The Rabbits, because I thought, okay, this is it's a book about the oppression of minority indigenous cultures. I thought, you know, kids are going to find this a little perplexing, and I didn't think of it as a kid's book at all. I thought it was my way of sneaking an adult book into the market under the disguise of a children's picture book. But kids are really smart. They really cottoned onto it. They could see what it was about. There's a part of the book that deals with the issue, which is referred to in Australia as the Stolen Generations, which is where Indigenous children were taken away from mm-hmm. their parents. We've
had similar.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be actually a pattern of colonial experience everywhere in the world, which I found fascinating, again, with my research that I did leading up to that book. And that was one that adults objected to, because it's still a little bit politically
sensitive.
Yes, like, you know, there's an element of the right wing that sort of denies it to some extent, while acknowledges that it happened, but doesn't see it as a negative thing necessarily. So that raised the ire of a number of right-wing critics, and the book was banned from some school libraries and things like that. Yeah, and I heard about, you know, various people getting very upset about it. But, you know, at the end of the day, kids make up their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they absorb things, but they also judge. And, you know, I think a book is a good medium for that, because it is fairly understated.
They prefer honesty.
Well, they'll know. Kids know if it's crap, you know.
Yeah.
They can detect it. They can detect the deceit.
If only adults were more...
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any plans for another graphic novel?
Not really. The thing about The Arrival is I didn't actually want it to be that long. I didn't want it to be in that style.
It just made itself.
Yeah, you know, I didn't necessarily choose that subject. It's just it came along. I sort of started doing this research. I thought this is a book that has to be done. You know.
Now that you're well recognized in the comic circles. And
yeah, I know. It's kind of sets you up to sort of do something else like that. It would have to be a subject that demands that kind of treatment.
Yeah. Well, I think that's art to itself, is do what wants, what needs to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
What propels itself.
I mean, chances are I might set out to do a comic and it would turn into an exhibition of paintings or something like that. I mean, you know, who knows?
Might wind up as a children's book.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, that's the thing. I think it was, you know, Cézanne said something about painting an apple, and it's like, you know, I don't want to paint that apple, but I have to. The picture demands that I do it, and I'm just a slave that listens to that demand. And that's the way a work is. It tells you what to do, and you know, you can Well, you can't really do much about it, you know. You feel compelled to just do it that way. It's like the sort of that pencil rendering in The Arrival. It's a very painful thing to do, I have to say. But I, like, had no choice. The book had to be like that. But I would like to do a sort of extended work, but it would probably be something quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see that just... it's a shame, too, because I've really got the hang of that kind of storytelling, so it would be so easy to adapt it to another project. But at the same time, what always attracts me to book projects is the novelty of starting a new book,
yeah,
and going on this adventure and not knowing how it's going to turn out, and playing with different media. So at the moment, I'm thinking of doing a picture book that's entirely sculptural.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it doesn't actually involve any drawing. It's actually modelling a scene. But I don't know about the logistics of that.
It's actually Phoebe Gleckner, her latest piece in this big book called I Live Here from Pantheon. She has a part in it that's about the women that go missing in Juarez, Mexico. And it's
mm-hmm.
all out of dolls.
All right.
And Phoebe, who's an incredible renter, no pencils involved here.
Mm.
It's all cloth dolls that she made herself into these displays, and quite violent and disturbing, but beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of examples of it, and it's always, I just find it so appealing, especially on some, you know, some vague memory of childhood level, you know.
Yeah.
Something about the approximation to toys or a modelled world is it has the potential to have a strong adult appeal in the way that a number of stop-motion animated films do, while still retaining a certain kind of playful innocence. And I like that, you know, like The Nightmare Before Christmas is such a great artistic object, because it sort of sits in that uncertain point
mm-hmm.
between sort of adult comprehension and a kind of childhood appeal. And it has that slight disturbance and rupture about it. And I think that's what you try to do whenever you create any visual art, is get to this point of outside of comfort,
yeah,
but still able to register what's going on. So I like to be challenged a little bit, not excessively.
Art shouldn't be easy.
Yeah. Well, it pushes you into a new realisation, and then when you solve that problem, that's quite exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have those problems in the first place.
You still want people to understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Because, at the end of the day, it's an act of communication too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of a tricky thing. Some art can afford to be a little bit more self-indulgent, where it's like a pure expression of a feeling or an idea, but when you're dealing with books, there is this something of a responsibility to communicate clearly, and you know, I think about 60% of my work is a form of editing, you know, and that the creative part is
the culling.
Yeah, well, yeah, just building a mass of stuff and then getting rid of all the bits that aren't going to, you know, they might communicate to me, but I know they're not going to communicate to other people. They're just going to be obscure or a little bit too personal, even a bit sentimental, and try and get rid of them.
Well, I think I've got my questions.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Yeah,
your,
no problem.
Odd time zone variants.
Yeah, that's all right.
And
that's good. It got me up and, you know,
ready for
in
the
Canadian time.
Don't ask us what that means.
Yeah, I guess you're quite...
We call this
like
Pacific time.
Pacific time, yes, of course.
Yes, although that wouldn't be the same as your Pacific time.
No, it's a it's a little different. But I'm Australia's got that similar girth. So growing up in Perth, I would working in Perth, which is a very isolated city and doesn't have much of a publishing industry, I'd be travelling across to Melbourne and Sydney often, and that's a 3-hour time difference, which I
mm-hmm.
imagine is similar to
from here to, say, Toronto or Montreal.
Yeah.
Or from New York to LA.
Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Sean.
Yeah,
and
you're welcome.
I hope you enjoy your extended Canadian vacation.
Yeah, thanks. I will. I'll try.
I'm fond of Nike shoes to keep myself tethered to the days I tried to lose. My mama said, slow down, you must make your own shoes. Stop dancing to the music, I'm caress in a happy mood.
Dead to the punk. Dead to the punk.